NBC News Radio, I'm Mike Becerra at the White House. In Florida, President Obama is unleashing a new Medicare offensive against Mitt Romney, saying the plan from the GOP ticket will cost seniors more money. NBC Meet the Press host David Gregory says it's an effective campaign tactic.
This is a battle over what will ultimately save Medicare, and you can bet that a lot of seniors are paying close attention to this, and even other voters who might be in their 40s or early 50s are paying attention.
Parts of New York City are cleaning up after two tornadoes touched down. Weather Channel meteorologist Reynolds Wolf describes the twisters.
These were not the classic wedge tornadoes that you sometimes see out in the northern plains, some of those that can be over a mile wide. These were pretty small.
The storms reach from Washington to New England, leaving much cooler temperatures today. Tropical Storm Leslie is moving northward on a path that's expected to take it east of Bermuda. It may strengthen to a weak hurricane. This is NBC News Radio. Fresh off a five-week vacation, lawmakers return to Washington on Monday. Their focus will be on preventing a government shutdown when the budget year ends September 30th. More than 400,000 Chicago students could be without a teacher as they head to school Monday. More than 26,000 teachers are threatening to strike as negotiations continue today.
Teachers are merely looking for, you know, what's fair and with the kids in mind. I wish it didn't have to come to this.
At issue is teacher pay and the Chicago union's resistance to teacher evaluations in the struggling school district. A neighborhood near Seattle, Washington, was startled when an object crashed from the sky.
A landing gear door from a passing Boeing 767 crashed to Earth Saturday. Luckily, the airplane part, the size of a refrigerator door, didn't hit anyone or any houses, but it did bring out the neighborhood, the police, and the FAA, which is investigating.
That's MSNBC's Alex Witt. I'm Mike Vaccara, NBC News Radio.
GEICO says, let's make life simpler.
It's a fact of modern life. Switching isn't easy. Your bank, your cable company, your girlfriend. Let's just say each switch comes with a certain degree of difficulty. But switching to GEICO, now that couldn't be easier. First of all, it only takes 15 minutes. And just like that, you could be saving hundreds on car insurance. No muss, no fuss, no irate, vengeful, significant others.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Safe Light Repair, Safe Light Replace.
Ryan, technician with Safe Light Auto Glass.
So you think all auto glass companies are the same? Well, they're not. With Safe Light, you get more. Every windshield we replace is backed by a national lifetime guarantee, keeping you covered wherever you are. Plus, Safe Light has more glass in stock than anyone, so we can get to you faster.
Just tell your insurance company you want Safe Light or call 1-800-800-2727 or go to safelight.com.
Federal News Radio, available on demand at federalnewsradio.com and on your smartphone with the free TuneIn Radio app.
federalnewsradio.com, your one-stop shop for all things federal. Listen daily to interviews with federal managers and government contractors. Read Mike Causey's daily federal report or just stop by for an update on the latest news affecting the federal community. federalnewsradio.com, your source for federal news now.
It's about smiles. It's about laughter. It's about going out and making a difference in the life of a child. You don't have to get mad. You just have to go mad. GoMad2011.com is a website dedicated to supporting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. At GoMad, our mission is simple, to go out and make a difference. So how can you help? Visit the Wish Wall on GoMad2011.com and make a contribution today. Or find out how you can donate with a simple text message. Do it now so that we can continue to touch the lives of children with life-threatening conditions by granting their wishes.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed O'Lara, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We're broadcasting from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce today. We have a great lineup of guests on our show, including Catherine Freeland, who's the CEO of a company called A-Tech, Peter Homan, the president of Able Industries, Brad King, the president of Government Services for Robbins Joya, and Kevin Harrington, the executive director of Friends House Retirement Community. Joining us first is a young lady by the name of Catherine Freeland, the CEO of a company called A-Tech. What is A-Tech, Catherine?
Well, A-Tech is an information technology and scientific data management company headquartered in Ellicott City, Maryland. Our primary customer base is the federal government, specifically the Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, Department of Justice, and the USDA.
When was the company founded?
Founded in 1996.
And how big or small today?
Today, we're a little over 200 employees. They're located in 26 cities across the United States. We'll do about $40 million this year.
And you've been with this company all along?
I have not. I started. I acquired A-Tech in April of 2010. So I've been the CEO a little over 2 years now.
So you bought this company?
I did.
Uh-huh. Why?
Why did I buy A-Tech? Well, I'm a serial entrepreneur, at least I think I am. This is my second time around as an entrepreneur. A-Tech had the qualifications and the characteristics of a company that we were really interested in, specifically, you know, the space that they operated in within the federal space.
So being a serial entrepreneur means you've done this before. So tell us about some of that.
I have done it before. I owned a company called RG2 Technologies back in the early 1990s that I started from the basement of my house, like most entrepreneurs do. And we were able to grow that company, me and my husband, Greg, was able to grow that company from a startup up to about a little over 200 or so employees by the time we left there. In 2006. I sold the company in 2003 to a publicly traded company and exited 3 years later.
Well, congratulations. Why get back into the business?
You know, have that entrepreneurial itch. My daughters were graduating from high school, and we decided we had better decide what we were going to do after they went off to school, so we decided to get back into the business.
Where are you from?
I'm originally from Birmingham, Alabama.
Uh-huh. A little bit more. What?
Birmingham, Alabama. Went to the public school system there in Alabama. I'm the youngest of five children. My father was a U.S. steel worker who worked there for like 35 years. My mom was a domestic. And one of the things that they always instituted in all of us was to work hard. He gave me three things that I was to accomplish in my lifetime. And that was to get a great education, the best that the public school systems of Birmingham had to offer, to go to college, get a great job, and then the last thing, which is the fourth thing, actually, was to marry a great man and to do it in that exact order.
And did you do that?
I did exactly that. I just married my husband the day before I graduated from college, so it counted.
So what was going on that compelled you to start a business?
Well, after I had left Birmingham and moved to the Washington metropolitan area, I immediately went to work for Beltway Bandit, well, you know, one of those government contractors around the Beltway. They taught me everything I needed to know about program management. They taught me how the government spent its dollars and how that budgeting process worked. I worked my way up within several of those companies. However, when I landed at the last company that a management position became available, I applied. I thought I was qualified. And I did not get that position. So as a result of that, I decided I needed to do something different. And I could have easily gone to work for another company. But instead, I decided I'd become an entrepreneur, not really knowing what an entrepreneur really was or what it all entailed. But I was willing to take the risk, and I stepped out and became an entrepreneur.
So you and your husband started the business?
We did.
What was that like?
Starting the business was scary. I wasn't a natural risk taker. My husband was. His background was marketing and business development. Mine was finance and business. So we coupled those two talents together, and we started it. And that's
good. You've got a tremendous focus and drive. Where does that come from? Were you like that as a kid?
I was not. I was very shy and quiet, believe it or not, even though I'm not that way now, but I was. I think it's just watching how hard my mom and dad worked, and I knew that I wanted to work hard, but I didn't want to work as hard as they were working and not making as much. And so I decided I would take along with me just some of those overall qualifications. Work hard, you shall succeed. Do my very best. Have a strong faith foundation, and I'll ultimately succeed in whatever it was I pursued.
When did that transition occur?
That transition occurred, I think, right after I experienced what I considered discrimination in the workplace. That's when the shift happened. And as a result, I've been working hard ever since, trying to be the best entrepreneur that I can be.
So talk about what you consider to be the discrimination in the workplace. A lot of people could be crushed by that. You weren't.
Again, it was a humbling experience. It was my first time experience what I classified as discrimination, even though I came from Birmingham, Alabama, where we know what the long-standing history is there. But the discrimination came about in my mind because I was an African-American female. I was doing the job. However, they brought in someone from the outside, actually a white male, who I ended up training. And as a result, that was the turning point for me. And so I consider that to be, in my mind, discrimination because I was doing the work.
And so what you decided to do then say, the heck with this, I'm going to start my own business?
Absolutely.
So talk about the early days of doing that. How did you guys fund it?
Well, initially we funded it on credit card debt, believe it or not. We could not find a bank that would give us a small business loan. We really didn't have a lot of background and past history to support it. And every business plan that I submitted, every bank turned us down. And that was the last resort, was really our credit. We didn't have a lot of collateral to go on, but we had a lot of credit.
So what is it about you and your husband that enabled you to hang in there and persevere?
Well, we were both driven. I think my husband probably had more entrepreneurial oomph than I did. However, we decided we were going to pool our resources together. We were going to work hard together, and we were going to succeed together.
When was the moment when you knew you were going to succeed? Tell us about that.
When we were able to move out of our basement, finally. We were in our basement for almost 3.5 years, and we were supporting our customers from there. So we made it look like we were much bigger than we were, but we really were not. However, our customers really didn't know it. We were delivering the services, and when we were able to move out of that basement into a 750-foot square foot building, we thought we had made it. And so we've been on a trajectory ever since.
Wonderful.
And you raised two girls.
We did. We raised my daughters. I have twin daughters that are just going into their sophomore year in college now. And they grew up with us as entrepreneurs. And that was a tough spot. They sacrificed a lot for us to be in business.
I've been through a number of meetings on the Anna Marie Slaughter article, and it's sort of often elitist, but you really had to deal with it on a day-to-day basis, being a mom, being a wife, being an entrepreneur. How did you deal with all those issues at once?
It was not an easy task, but I relied on a strong support system. I was a new mom, and now I had two babies and not really knowing what I was doing. So I really had to rely upon a strong support system. That support system consisted of my sisters and my best friends and my neighbors. They all helped me try to figure out what I was doing to raise these children while at the same time trying to be an entrepreneur and to be a wife. And so it was about balance. And I was not balanced in the beginning. I learned to become balanced, but that balance came as a result of having a strong support system to assist me.
How long have you been married?
I've been married 27 years.
So that's extraordinary. Not every husband and wife starts a business, raises a family, and stays together.
Yes.
How have you guys done it?
It has not been easy because we're both A-type personalities. We are very strong-willed individuals. But I think what has caused us to work well together is because we understand what our swim lanes are. Mm-hmm. You know, Greg operates very well in his area of marketing, business development, and I operate very well in everything else, everything ops. And so we balance each other out. And I think that's really what has helped us to stay married and be business partners at the same time.
So you're the CEO of ATEC now, right?
Yes.
Where did you learn how to lead?
Some of it was trial and error, believe it or not. I learned a lot in business school, but they don't teach you how to be a CEO in business school.
How would you characterize your leadership style?
I think I'm one of a very collaborative leader. I try to lead by example. I have a strong faith foundation. I'm not afraid to say that as a leader within my company. And I try to bring others in, you know, into my circle to help me in those areas where I don't know. I'm a CEO that knows that what I don't know. I know what I don't know.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
The toughest thing that I've ever accomplished, I would say being a mom. That is one thing that I pride myself on. That I worked really, really hard at being a great mom. My mom was a great example for me, but she was an old school mom who didn't say a lot. And I'm a new school mom, but I wanted to take some of the aspects from what she taught me and to convey those over to my daughters. And I think as a result, my daughters have grown up to be strong young women.
Are your mom and dad aware of your success?
My mom and dad are. My dad passed away about 6 years ago. My mom passed away this year in April. And so they were able to see me achieve the success that we've achieved today.
Were they surprised?
They were not surprised.
If I was interviewing them right now, I was talking to your dad, what would he say about you?
He would say, that's my baby girl. That she listened well, and she took my advice, and we're very proud of her.
And if he was sitting here right now, what would you like to say to him?
I would tell him just how happy I am being his daughter, and I would thank him for all the lessons that he taught me to help me to be the woman that I am today.
And how about your mom?
My mom was a great mom. She taught me to be strong. She taught me never to say no, never to give up and quit. Mm-hmm. And if she was here today, I would tell her what I tell her every day, that I am her sunshine. And that how proud I am to be her daughter. And,
Wonderful.
That's what I would tell her.
What's the website address, Catherine?
You can find us at atech.net, and that's atech.net.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Catherine Freeland, who's the CEO of Atech. I'd like to thank my co-host Ed Allera with Buchanan Ingersoll and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment after this business spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies bringing you your business spotlight. Joining us today is
Tony Cancelosi from the Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind.
And Tony, what brings you here today?
Well, we're here today to talk about our Light the Way 5K race at National Stadium on September 29th, which is a Saturday. And to talk about why we're having this 5K race, it's for veterans, visually impaired and blind veterans, also individuals who are visually impaired and blind. But the unique thing about this race, it's chaired by Mark Lerner, one of the principal owners of the Nationals, and Steve Niergall, the regional president of Safeway. The interesting part is that this is the first sanctioned 5K race by the waterfront. It'd be very exciting for runners who want to be timed and win a prize. But also it's a walk fun race for individuals and families. But also the unique thing about this race is that you have the opportunity to guide someone who's visually impaired and blind in the race.
So if I understand that, then you can be visually impaired and still do this race. This is not just people that can see and run.
Absolutely. And the opportunity to guide somebody is a very unique experience. The best part about this race is the sponsors. We have some great sponsors, naturally the Nationals, Safeway. We have a very unique opportunity for you to come out and enjoy lots of food. It's catered by Geppetto's Caterer Barbecue. We have Utz potato chips. We have Coca-Cola. We have Nestle's chocolate.
Oh, sounds like a great place.
Oh, it's fantastic.
How do people find out more about this? How do they contact you?
All you have to do is go to register online, wwclb.org.
www.clb.org. And there's registration there for the 5K walk race. That's great. This is Paul from Potomac Companies, and this has been your Business Spotlight. Thank you.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Allera, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Peter Homan, who's the president of Able Industries. What is Able Industries, Peter?
Able Industries is a company that provides cleaning supplies to the big, extensive industry that we have in the Washington, D.C. area. That encompasses many products from toilet paper all the way to floor machines and what's in between.
And when was the company started?
I started the company in 1971. That would be April.
And so that's about 31 years ago?
I think if you checked your arithmetic, you'd find that to be about 41 years.
Oh, you're right.
42, it's 42, actually, yeah.
That's right. How big or small is the company today?
Started it from nothing with $5,000, and today we're doing about $12.5
million. That's quite an accomplishment. Why start a business?
My grandfather had 11 brothers and one sister. Every one of them had a small business, and this was in Wales, North Wales, which is part of the UK.
Right.
They were mostly barbers and tobacconists. My father, during World War II, even though he had worked for the government and still did, started a bicycle business. And when I was a little boy, at the age of 5 in Liverpool, England, I used to help my mother service customers and sweep the place out. We came to this country because my father got transferred to Washington, D.C. I was 10 years old in 1948, but I never forgot the entrepreneurial benefit of doing something for yourself.
That's a great story. So what was it like to come to this country as a 10-year-old?
This is 1948. I left England. Really didn't want to come at that time because I was quite happy with my school chums and friends, my bicycle, because I knew it now had a bicycle, which you couldn't get work during the war years. And we came to New York in August, and I still had my little wool pants and wool sweater on, and it was 96 degrees. We thought we had landed in hell. No air conditioning, not as much as we have now.
Yeah.
And then we came to Washington, D.C. My uncle, who had lived in this country since the 20s, picked us up in Washington. In New York.
Right.
And in those days, you didn't have the interstate highway or the turnpike, and you didn't have a bridge over the Delaware. So it was quite a long trip. Yeah. So that's how my arrival was in the area.
And you said in the green room that it wasn't just a walk in the park being a 10-year-old in this country. Tell us about that.
I actually ended up in Arlington. We lived in Arlington. And there was still in those days, right after 3 years after World War II, you had a housing shortage. So we had an apartment. And I went to Woodrow Wilson Elementary School in 1948 in the fifth grade. I was the only foreign student there. So the pecking order with the boys was that you had to prove yourself. And, of course, I ended up with many bruises and a couple of bloody noses. They challenged me, so I had to stick up for myself. And I think I did quite well, really.
Yeah,
and I wasn't bothered after that.
Yeah. Looking back on it, what do you think, though, coming to the United States, having to make your own way, get your own credibility, taught you that made you the successful guy that you are today?
Well, I think what it taught me was that I had the benefit of not being micromanaged, and I was able to be a self-starter. 2 months after arriving here, I was asked to take over a paper route, which I did. And in 1948, I was making almost $40 a month as a 10-year-old. And after that, it just kept going. If the shopping center where I lived needed some help, chains on in the wintertime, laundromat that I worked for, washing down machines, and we didn't question what the minimum wage was in those days. We were just glad to have a job. I think my first job in the laundromat, I was making 35 cents an hour, probably breaking some of the child labor laws that we have today. But anyway, it was a good experience. And what it did, really, it put a child with adults, so you knew how to handle yourself and do it in the correct fashion. It also taught you how to do a good job, because in those days, people did not tolerate poor performance.
Right. What did you do with the money you made back then?
I opened a little savings account in the Arlington Trust. And what I would do, now I think you have to have parents signing everything. In those days, your little child could go in and open his own account. And every week when I had some money, and I got lots of tips doing all these things, I put it in my little savings account. And in those days, it wasn't computerized. They'd do an entry with a pen.
Right.
And then when somebody needed a present, like my father, I bought him a watch. My mother, I bought her some stuff for the house. So I enjoyed giving some of it away.
Yeah, what did it feel like to be able to do that at such a young age?
It gave me a great feeling of independence and the fact that I felt that I could take care of myself.
Uh-huh. So you went to high school, and did you go to college?
Never went to college. I actually, in getting out of high school, I had a part-time job. My father worked for the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. He took care of the Ministry of Works. These are the people that take care of the maintenance and the engineering and all the rest of it. Right from the age of 14, every summer, I had a part-time job. And when I was 15 with my part-time job, I became a teletype operator, working the teletype signals going back to London. So I had to arrive at a certain time, and I had to leave at a certain time. That was relatively easy because my dad worked there, and he could drop me off, okay? And that was in Washington, D.C. So I did that job, and when I got to be in the junior year at Washington Lee, they asked me if I would come and work full-time. So I dropped out of high school, but 2 months later, I did sign up for a night school at Emerson Institute, which I eventually graduated with a high school diploma. But then, at that point, I was really engrossed into my career.
So that was mid-50s, roughly.
That would be 1957, I believe.
So I was engrossed in my career. What would you call your career?
My career was making money.
Money.
That's my career, and it still is today.
Okay.
But you had a hiatus where you worked for a very, very large company.
Well, to work for a very large company like Procter & Gamble and not have a college degree, you have to be exceptional.
So why did they hire you?
They had a situation in the Washington, D.C. area where they weren't getting the amount of sales in the industrial area. So they were competing very heavily with Lever and Colgate in those days. And I already had a work background in sales.
How'd you convince them to hire you?
Well, I'm a very convincing person. I can show you my record of success. And I think, you know, it's wonderful to have a college education. And as I said, most of my family do. And I have a son with a PhD, and I've got cousins that were all kinds of educators and academics. But college really didn't interest me in those days because I knew that I could make a lot of money. And if I would go to college, I'd need about 4 to 5 years. And I thought I'd be better off doing it for myself with the ultimate goal of eventually having my own business.
So was it after your stint with Procter & Gamble that you started your business?
No. When I was with Procter & Gamble, I started in the retail and then went to the institutional, which is like industrial, where you have the hotel motels.
Right.
And I met a lot of people. So I felt that the next step for me would be eventually to get into the janitorial supply business. So I worked for a small company for a year before I started my own business. Keep in mind, I had a wonderful wife that would work with me. She didn't have a job. We had 3 children.
Yeah.
And I only had $5,000.
So talk about the early days. Well, actually, tell me, what was going on the moment you decided I need to start my own business? What were you thinking with a young wife and family?
I had an opportunity. And you know the old saying, opportunity only knocks once, or does it knock twice? Some people it's 3 times. With me, it was this once. And I'd always told my wife, wonderful person, worked with me, that it would be very difficult. But if the right opportunity were to come along, I would grab it. And this opportunity did come along. And it is in regards to rags or wiping cloths.
So how did you know it, though? What was it about the opportunity, or what is it about you that knew this was the right thing?
Because this was something you could have a niche.
Uh-huh.
Plus, it was innovative. It was brand new.
Yeah, but how did you know what a niche is? You don't have a formal education. What did you know?
Do you think that maybe I had street smarts from my little background of being a paper boy and working in all these other odd jobs?
So you could figure
it
out.
Also, you're missing out. One of my jobs, I drove a bread truck. And I made 10% commission. So that was very good. Then I worked for Keebler Biscuit Company selling cookies.
Well, you make it sound so easy. Talk about the toughest thing you've ever done.
I think the toughest thing I had to do was to grow a business without having a big line of credit. I had the capability to sell much more than what I had the finances to do. So I always had to limit the amount of suits that I could make from a piece of cloth. And that is very, very difficult. And this is where a lot of little businesses get into trouble, yeah, because they try to grow too quickly without adequate capitalization.
Real quick, Peter, what's your proudest moment up till now?
I think my proudest moment up to this point is having a beautiful, wonderful wife that allowed me to have 8 wonderful children and 32 grandchildren.
And what's the website address for Able Industries?
It's www.able, spelled A-B-E-L, supply, S-U-P-P-L-Y, .com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Peter Homan, who's the president of Able Industries. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed O'Leary, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
Joining us today is Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say 3 things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed O'Leary, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a guy by the name of Brad King, president of Government Services for Robbins Gioia. What is Robbins Gioia, Brad?
Well, Robbins Gioia is a company that's been around for about 30 years. It was formed by a retired general and a retired colonel who came out of the government and realized that there was a market for people with professional program management experience and skills, and basically created the marketplace for program management support services to the federal government.
And what is program management for people that aren't familiar with it?
Well, very large programs, large defense acquisition programs for big systems like B-2 bombers and F-15s, F-18s. They're very large and complex programs that have very, you know, huge bills of materials for what goes into those, the schedules for bringing all those materials together in the supply chain to match up on the production floor to be produced into an airplane. You know, that's a very complex process, and it requires a specific set of skills to integrate both the program schedule and also to to route things through the
And
process.
That's what your company does.
And our company helps the government do that, yes.
Right. And how big or small is the company today?
We have about 350 employees. We'll have revenues north of $50 million this year.
And when did you join the company?
I've been with the company for about 12 weeks.
12 whole weeks. How did that come to be?
Well, I was I was running a company called Library Systems and Services. We were operating public libraries throughout the United States. And I had the opportunity to meet these guys, a management team, a guy named Jim Leto, who had actually run the company before and sold it, invited me to join a management team to buy the company back from a UK owner.
And why did you want to do that?
Well, it's actually something that I've been working on doing for about 8 years. The first part of my career was really focused in what I would call the traditional corporate life, and I left that in 2006 and spent a few years working with private equity funds to look at companies in this space. But the ambition was to find myself in the position that I'm in today, which is an equity shareholder in a business that we believe we can grow.
It sounds like a really well thought out approach. Why did you know that you had to spend time with equity?
Well, thank you for giving me credit for it being well thought out. I think that what I actually discovered when I left Serco, a company that I had run as their North American CEO for about 3 years, I was probably naive more than anything, and I quickly realized that I needed to partner with somebody in the private equity world to really understand how to put a deal like that together. And so I started to work with a great company in New York called Berman Capital, and I worked with them to look at businesses in this space, and I learned a tremendous amount from that process. We probably looked at 100 companies quickly, and we probably looked at 20 or so in depth, and it was a great experience to do that.
A lot of press out there about private equity, good and bad. Why is private equity so important for the process of American business?
Yeah, it's interesting. The private equity world, I would kind of divide it up into some different segments. I think that there are some private equity funds that are sort of the great big hedge fund based companies that are doing turnarounds. That's not the flavor that I'm interested in. I'm more interested in what I would call private equity, which is companies that are wanting to invest over the long haul with a leadership team. And I think that they play a very important role in our economy because they're able to take assets that are important to in our space in particular, that are important to the nation, and help them perform better and apply their capital in a more effective way and grow and be stronger in support of their mission.
Great.
But it's a different leadership skill set required because you're leveraged a little bit differently. Tell me about the difference between Serco and running this company.
Well, obviously, with Serco, we were part of a company that was traded on the London Stock Exchange, well capitalized, great balance sheet, great history, and so if we needed capital to invest in a project, it was we called London and they sent cash and we went and executed the deal. Whereas in a smaller environment like this, where we're basically entrepreneurs, we have to be a little bit more creative in the way that we have to think about that side of the equation a lot more than you do in a more traditional corporate environment, which is something that I frankly enjoy.
Well, you've got a team of people. How did that team come together, and why did they select you?
Well, it's a great story. I probably shouldn't tell it all, but the reality is that a guy named Ron Bolin, who had been consulting with the UK owner of this company for a while, they were frustrated and fearful, frankly, that the business continued to decline, and they didn't want to see that happen on their watch. They were, because of a thing called a proxy board that you have to have in place that sort of insulated the business from the UK ownership, they weren't able to exercise a level of control that they might otherwise have exercised over the years. And so they decided that the best thing to do for the business was to find a management team that could come back in and start to turn it around. So Ron Bolin was consulting with them on that matter, and they asked him if he would be interested in putting together a team. He reached out to Jim Lito, who I mentioned earlier, who had run the company before, who had run PRC, which is a great American company, and sold that. He had run Robbins Joya prior to its being sold, so he knew a lot about the company. But they wanted somebody that had built a small business into a big business in this marketplace. I got to know Ron through one of the board members of a company that I was running prior to this, and so I was basically recommended by a board member of a company that I was running before.
Yeah, what makes the opportunity so exciting that you would bet the farm on this?
Well, it's a rare bird. There are a lot of opportunities out there for management to participate in a deal with a private equity fund, for example, where they're putting up the capital. But to have a transaction that you can participate in where the management team owns 100% of the company and we don't have any private equity investors that we have to talk to simplifies it and, frankly, makes it a more powerful business proposition that I was very excited to be a part of.
Yeah. So where are you from, Brad?
I grew up in Kansas.
I had
a great childhood in Kansas. It was a, you know.
What's childhood in Kansas like?
Well, you wake up on a summer morning at crack of dawn, and you get some food, and you take off on your bike, and you show up again about 10:30 at night, sweaty and ready to go to sleep. So it was a great childhood. But that's where I'm from. My parents were both in the aerospace and defense industry, which is kind of how I vectored into this space.
Mm-hmm.
My mom, 35 years as a electrical drafts person at Beach, and my dad. Retired. He started as a machinist, and it was sort of interesting. I went to work for Boeing right out of college. I spent 9 years at Boeing, and during the course of my career in finance there, I had a responsibility for a part of the company that was doing modernization work on the B-52. Well, my dad worked on wind tunnel models of the B-52, so, and frankly, that airplane is still flying. But my dad retired as an engineer running an advanced airframes lab there in Wichita.
So what was it like as a young person watch your father just climb up the ladder one step at a time?
Yeah, you know, Dad was a remarkable guy. He didn't have a college education, and he frankly couldn't do that today. That's just not possible. But he was a guy that was great with his hands and had a brilliant mind for mathematics and how to solve problems. And that's why he was running the lab when he retired, is he was a guy that could take a very difficult problem. They put him in a position where he had unlimited resources and he could solve some pretty interesting problems, and he did. And he was always very proud when he would see, some of our more advanced aircraft and systems going into the theaters of war and seeing him be successful and knowing that he was a part of that.
Mm-hmm. How do you think you were shaped by him?
Oh, wow.
If it was just one thing.
I think that just never stop trying.
Uh-huh. How about your mom?
My mom was she was the one that sort of communicated for Dad. If he wanted to have a personal conversation with me, he'd usually tell my mom what he wanted me to hear. She was much better at that. Mom, I guess the most important thing I got from my mom is probably my faith.
Other mentors along the way that have had significant influences on you?
Yeah, I've had some really interesting mentors. I think a guy that I think about a lot is a guy named Russ Gordon, who was maybe I shouldn't say this on radio, but he was a crusty old Jewish merchant in Wichita, Kansas, and I had the opportunity to go to work for him. And I spent about 9 years in that business while I was going through college. And he continued to be a mentor to me until he died. He would come by and he'd grab me and he'd say, come with me. And we'd go to his office and we'd get on the phone and he'd chew out some vendor. He says, I'm going to give you a hard ass lesson today. And because he always thought I was too soft, and I probably am. But he was a great mentor to me.
What's your proudest moment up till now?
Wow. I guess. There's some achievements in business. I'm pretty proud of my kids.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's usually what we hear. So congratulations on that. What's the website address, Brad?
It's www.robbinsjoya.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Brad King, who's the president of the government services of Robbins Joya. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Allaire, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies bringing you your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Tony Cancelosi from the Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind.
And Tony, what brings you here today?
Well, we're here today to talk about our Light the Way 5K race at National Stadium on September 29th, which is a Saturday, and to talk about why we're having this 5K race. It's for veterans, visually impaired and blind veterans, also individuals who are visually impaired and blind. But the unique thing about this race, it's chaired by Mark Lerner, one of the principal owners of the Nationals, and Steve Niergall, the regional president of Safeway. The interesting part is that this is the first sanctioned 5K race by the waterfront. Be very exciting for runners who want to be timed and win a prize. But also it's a walk fun race for individuals and families. But also the unique thing about this race is that you have the opportunity to guide someone who's visually impaired and blind in the race.
So if I understand that, then you can be visually impaired and still do this race. This is not just people that can see and run.
Absolutely. And the opportunity to guide somebody is a very unique experience. The best part about this race is the sponsors. We have some great sponsors, naturally the Nationals, Safeway. We have a very unique opportunity for you to come out and enjoy lots of food. It's catered by Geppetto's Caterer Barbecue. We have Utz potato chips. We have Coca-Cola. We have Nestle's chocolate.
Oh, sounds like a great place.
Oh, it's fantastic.
How do people find out more about this? How do they contact you?
All you have to do is go to register online, wwclb.org.
www.clb.org. And there's registration there for the 5K walk race. That's great. This is Paul from Potomac Companies, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Allaire, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we have Kevin Harrington, the Executive Director of Friends House Retirement Community, for this segment. And what is the Friends House Retirement Community, Kevin?
Friends House Retirement Community is a continuing care retirement community located in Sandy Spring, Maryland. It's a nonprofit, faith-based organization that cares for senior living. We have independent living, assisted living, and skilled nursing care. It is sponsored by the Society of Friends, or Quakers. It's 45 years old as of this month, and we are a little 63-acre campus that has a lot of nature to it.
So it's an interesting story how this got started. Why don't you tell it to us?
All right. Back in the late 30s, a group of Quakers from the Washington, D.C. area had wanted to start a retirement community. They searched for many years, and in the late 60s were granted some land in Sandy Spring. Sandy Spring is, as I said earlier, in Montgomery County, but it has long traditional roots to the Quaker faith. Going back to the 1700s. There was a parcel of 63 acres that was given to Friends House, and at that time Friends House wanted to focus on low to moderate income residents, and they went out and got the first, in 1967, one of the first HUD loans that the federal government ever gave out. So at that time 100 HUD apartments were built.
Yeah, but what you were telling us in the green room is this particular Quaker community had something to do with the Underground Railroad?
Well, back in Sandy Spring being so old and Quaker, there's Underground Railroad trails and tours that are given out in that area. So you can walk. We have probably about 13 acres of woods that has trails that, you know, back in the late mid-1800s, you know, the slaves would escape the South and going to the North would find refuge in the Sandy Spring community.
That's great. And how long have you been with the organization?
This November I'll be there 3 years.
Why did you join this particular organization?
Well, it was really the quality of people, and we have a board of directors that are 19 board members who are Quakers. They are all volunteers, non-paid volunteers, and they are the people who decide what goes on at Friends House. They needed a management team, and talking to them and the values, the Quaker values they have. Many Quaker values are universal. simplicity, peace, nonviolence, integrity, some of the things that we try to teach our children when we're younger. It just was a good fit.
Tell us about your background.
Well, in 1982, I graduated from Mount St. Mary's with a BS in accounting and worked in public accounting for several years. Then went into work for Marriott, and at that time, Marriott had introduced a new business called Senior Living, and I was on the ground floor of that strategic business unit. We had 15 communities and had grown to about 150. That's where, for 15 years, learned the senior living business. Marriott exited out of that business and sold the senior business to Sunrise, and at that time I spent 5 years with Sunrise and then wanted to go into a nonprofit.
Well, senior living, this Quaker community was at the forefront of that. But it has evolved, although a nonprofit, it's still a very tough business. What leads you into that business?
Well, you know, it's the relationships with the residents. They are people that you really get to know, and Tom Brokaw wrote the book Greatest Generation. They're truly your greatest generation. They're the ones that made this country better for us. And some of the things they lived through and designed and made better for us, you know, for me and my children and future generations here. So that's what really drives me. I love the ability to help these residents and give them some dignity, as they age. And, I get just as much from them as they give to me every day.
So at what point was there a moment when this stopped becoming a job and became the passion for you?
I think the last few years, especially at Friend's House, I'm there. You know, I don't count the clock of how many hours I'm there. I'm always there, it seems like. But, you know, if there's a snowstorm or a bad storm, you know, I'm there to make sure they're okay. And once they're okay, I go home, you know, take care of what I have to take care of at home.
Well, you sound to be the antithesis of the article in the Washington Post and that experience. Mm-hmm. How did you get there?
Well, you know, that Post article, you know, came out. It was kind of a little bit of black eye because originally the gentleman who wrote the article was a senior who moved into an assisted living community and wanted to meet the management. And he was just talking to management, and the management came across to them, hey, you know, you're just a renter. You pay rent, and, you know, we make the decisions around here. And that's the wrong attitude to have in this type of industry. Our residents, really, it's a sense of community, and they're the ones that drive the engine of the community. And, you know, what they need and what they want, they can tell us, and we can execute it for them. My biggest job is to listen to their feedback, give them what they want, and exercise it within our budget restraints, you know. And the other side of that is the risk management end of it. You know, you want to make sure they're safe and they're sound and they're exercising good choices themselves. You know, you have sometimes issues where seniors, you know, are in their 90s and they're driving, and should they be driving? But you don't want to take away it gives them some freedom. You know, they still want choices, and exercising those choices is the best way.
What's the toughest part of your job?
The toughest part of my job is watching residents decline, I think.
How do you handle that?
You're there with them, and you see them every day, and you try to give them what they need and a sense of dignity. And sometimes it's hard for them to ask their families for that because their families just don't understand what their parents are going through. And I've seen it over and over again that, you know, some people are coming to the end of their lives, and they just want to live as, you know, best possibly they can live. So if it means that, you know, they have to work with a walker, they'll work with a walker, but they still want to be, they don't want people doing all of the work for them. They just want you to be give them some kind of helping hand or understanding or make them still positive.
So you're not in the retirement home community business. You're in the preserving the dignity business.
Well, yes, preserving dignity, but making sure that they have a fulfilled life to the day they die.
Where are you from, Kevin?
I'm from originally, since I've been 14, been in the Montgomery County, Maryland area. Before that, was born and raised in the New York City area. So I've been around here for at least 45 years.
Where did this need to do the work that you do come from, looking back on it?
Well, you know, it's probably embedded in from my parents, you know, the service. My father worked for the federal government. It was a service industry there, you know, giving back to your community. So that's really where it drives. And, you know, the residents give back just as much to me by, you know, they're just so kind, so thankful, complimentary. They kind of reassure you yourself when you're talking to them.
How do you get your management team and your employees to buy into this in this commercial crass age we live in?
Right. It can be tough sometimes. When you're hiring, you look for a caring heart. You try to pull that out in the interview process.
How do you know you have a caring heart in front of you?
Well, there's a series of questions you can ask. You usually take a staff member touring through the community, too. See if they can interact with residents who are sitting there, saying hi, getting in conversation, or if they deftly walk right by them. You know, they can't grasp this kind of business.
Yeah, what's the biggest misconception you'd like to clear up about the whole aging thing?
Well, you know, they can do just as much as we can do. I mean, we have a large garden at our community. We have residents who work out there who are in their 80s and 90s, and I think they're just as physically strong as I am in my 50s.
What's the proudest moment for you up till now?
Well, you know, I'm, you know, my family and seeing where my children are going. I have two that have graduated from college and are very successful. I have two in college. You know, they come to the community themselves. I have my two sons that just worked this summer in the maintenance staff at the community. And, you know, just the compliments I've gotten back from the residents every day about how they act and behave themselves and carry on. That's, you know, if I'm creating a generation, the next generation, I'm very happy to see what my children have done.
Great. What's the website address, Kevin?
It's www.friendshouse.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Kevin Harrington, who's the executive director for Friends House Retirement Community. I'd like to thank my co-host today, Ed Allaire, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interviews. And we've had a terrific lineup of guests on the show today, including Catherine Freeland, who's the CEO of A-Tech, Peter Homan, the president of Able Industries, Brad King, the president of Government Solutions of Robbins Joya, and finally Kevin Harrington, the executive director of Friends House Retirement Community. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a
a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts